I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We want to begin the program today by talking about President Obama's call again to close the military detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. Here he is speaking at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C.
I know the politics are hard, but history will cast a harsh judgment on this aspect of our fight against terrorism and those of us who fail to end it. Imagine a future 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, when the United States of America is still holding people who have been charged with no crime on a piece of land that is not part of our country.
New polls suggest the American people are still divided on whether to close the facility, but it has faced vocal criticism for years now, and one surprising voice has joined that chorus. Morris Davis is the former chief prosecutor for terrorism trials at Guantanamo Bay. He tried some of its most high-profile terror cases, but now he's calling for the facility to be closed. He's also a retired Air Force officer who retired at the rank of colonel. He's an associate professor at Howard University School of Law, and he's with us now, just minutes after the speech ended. Colonel Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
You attended this speech by invitation from the White House. Was that surprising to you, given that you've been such a critic?
Yeah, I thought they'd made a mistake, but I responded back, and they responded back saying they were glad I could attend, and I was really, really pleased that they made that step.
You've said that the president has talked the talk but hasn't walked the walk on Guantanamo. How about apart from contending with a heckler in the audience, first of all, how do you think that he did, and how was the speech received?
Well, the speech was well received. You know, the military never wanted Guantanamo to begin with. It was something that was kind of, not kind of, it was crammed down our throat by political appointees in the Bush administration. So I think in a military audience, and it was largely a military audience, that it was a receptive group because, as the president said, it's a blight on our reputation. So I think the military would be happy to get rid of this mission. You know, the president has always been great with rhetoric. I mean, he's been great with rhetoric back to 2008 when he said, you know, Guantanamo was an abomination and it had to be closed, and a lot of the same things he said today. So it's really a question now whether the rhetoric can be matched by reality. So that remains to be seen.
And needless to say, at this point, it's not just up to him, and we can talk about that in a minute, and I hope we will. But I do want to talk more about your own story. You became chief prosecutor in 2005. Did you welcome that assignment?
I did. You know, for an attorney, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do something like this, to be involved in an important part of our nation's history. So when the opportunity came along, I jumped at it and did it for a little over 2 years before I resigned from the position. But if I had the choice to go back and do it again, I'd do it again because it was fascinating work with some really good people.
And I wanted to talk about that because in June of 2007, you wrote an op-ed for the New York Times titled "The Guantanamo I Know." And in it, you wrote that the facility is, quote, a clean, safe place for enemy combatants. 4 months later, you resigned. What happened?
Well, I think Guantanamo is, as far as a physical facility goes, I think there are a lot of Americans that are incarcerated that if they saw Guantanamo would trade places in a minute. It's not overcrowded. In fact, it's underpopulated, really. I've eaten the food. I've seen the medical care. It's as far as physical facilities go, it's as good as you're going to get. But it's the underlying basis for why we went there to begin with, which was to avoid the law. You know, for 200 years, the law was our strength. And then after 9/11, we wanted to avoid it. And so Guantanamo was thought to be outside the reach of the U.S. courts, the international courts, the Cuban courts. It was a law-free zone that was going to be the perfect place to exploit people for intelligence. When I took the job, and I think for the better part of nearly 2 years, I believed we were committed to having full, fair, and open trials. And I hoped that we would be able to do this in a way that our grandkids would look back at Guantanamo the way we look at Nuremberg. And it was towards the end of my tenure in the summer of 2007 when some new political appointees came in above me that said, hey, wait a minute, you know, you're not using this information obtained by waterboarding and these other techniques. If President Bush says we don't torture, who are you to say that we do? So this evidence you're not using, you need to use. And then we had the political meddling from the Bush White House. Those combination of factors led me to believe that we weren't going to do this right and it wasn't going to be full, fair, and open. And I didn't want to be a part of that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Colonel Morris Davis. He's the former chief prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay. He is now fighting to close the military prison. You recently delivered a petition to the White House with, what, almost 400,000 signatures urging the president to close the facility. But there are two recent polls. One was by Huffington Post, and I think YouGov, another was by Fox News, suggested that a slight majority of Americans favor keeping Guantanamo open. Why do you think that is?
I think, you know, we used to be known as the land of the free and the home of the brave. And after 9/11, we've become the constrained and the cowardly, where we've lived in this perpetual state of fear. And I think the public bought into that narrative that these guys are all the worst of the worst. I think the Obama administration has done a poor job of educating the public, because I think if the public knew the truth, they would have a different opinion. I don't think the public's aware that 86 of the 166 men at Guantanamo that were paying almost $1 million each per year to keep there, the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Justice, Department of Defense have unanimously agreed that those 86 men are not going to be charged with a crime, they're not an imminent threat to the U.S., and we don't want to keep them.
Are you surprised that a person with your profile, career military, retired at a high rank, distinguished public servant, that you haven't had more headway?
I'm disappointed. I mean, I've been really surprised in the last few weeks. I think I feel more vindication out of the public stepping up and saying, we agree this has got to stop, this isn't America.
But as we note, and just to close the loop on the conversation as we began it, Congress has now determined that no funds can be used to close the facility and to relocate prisoners within the borders of the United States, as I understand. So what happens now?
Well, I think it's going to be a process of educating the public and getting Congress to quit being cowards. If Guantanamo remains as is to the end of President Obama's administration, we'll have spent another $750 million to keep 166 men in prison, half of which we don't want to keep in prison. That's not America. The president did a nice job of laying out the argument about it being a waste of money, a waste of our prestige. It's generated bad law, and it's just unnecessary when we've got our federal prisons and our federal courts that can easily accommodate the ones that need to be confined and prosecuted. There is no good argument for Guantanamo other than just political points.
Are there countries that are willing to take these detainees?
Well, again, there are 166 that are still at Guantanamo, many that have been there for more than 11 years. They fall into three categories. You've got a group of 86 that I mentioned that have been cleared. Those should be pretty easy. 56 of the 86 are from Yemen. They were in the process of being repatriated. We had the Christmas Day 2009 underwear bomber, you know, who was trained in Yemen, and that's when we quit sending people back to Yemen. The Yemeni government wants their people back. So that would be 56 right off the top that they would take. You have others like Shakir Amar from the UK that they want back. So there are a number that the countries are willing to take back if we will permit them to do so. There's some others in that group, though, that are more problematic, like the Uyghurs, the Chinese Muslims, that we early on determined weren't a threat to the U.S. They didn't hate us. They were training to fight China. And China would love to have them back for about a day. We have begged and bribed other countries to help us out in solving the problem we created. So Bermuda, for instance, took four of the Uyghur detainees. We have never taken a single one. You would think we could be as brave as Bermuda. And other countries, when we go to them, begging them to help us solve the problem we created, they're not particularly sympathetic when we're unwilling to help ourselves and take some of these cleared detainees here. There's about 30 the administration intends to prosecute. And then you've got that group of about 50 that the president mentioned that are the ones that we don't intend to prosecute and we don't want to send home. We've detained those people saying that we're at war, and for the duration of the war, we have the right to detain the enemy. But as the president also talked about, by the end of 2014, we're going to end combat operations in Afghanistan. So this argument that these are wartime detainees, even that argument is going to evaporate come 2014. So we've either got to find a way to prosecute these people or send them home, or we're going to have to create some new legal fiction to justify their detention.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask, if you don't mind, you spent most of your adult life in the military. You are an officer of the court. By definition, you are a believer in the rule of law. And I just wondered if it surprises you to find at this stage of your life that you've spent the last couple of years basically fighting the government that you served. You know, you swore to defend the Constitution of the United States, and obviously you very much believe in your country. You've served it for such a long time. I'm just wondering if it's surprising to you to find that this is what you're doing at this stage of your life.
Well, it certainly isn't what I had planned or envisioned, but you're exactly right. My father was a 100% disabled veteran of World War II who believed very strongly in his country and was never bitter about being 100% disabled. You know, going off to the war as a healthy young man and coming back, you know, totally disabled. So I think he instilled that sense of duty and honor and commitment to the country. So I'm disappointed in my government, but I believe in my country, and I believe in the fundamental goodness of the American people. They get scared, and for the last 11 years, people have done their best to keep them in a state of fear. But I think at the end of the day, the Constitution triumphs. It's been encouraging, you know, lately that you know, people seem to be coming around to, you know, some of the things I've argued for a number of years. So I'm not ready to give up. I mean, I joined, you know, the military to defend the Constitution, and I think I'm still fighting that fight.
Colonel Morris Davis was the chief prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay from 2005 to 2007. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Colonel Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. By now you might have heard that the Boy Scouts of America have reached a decision to end the ban on openly gay scouts, but not scout leaders. The Barbershop Guys will talk about that in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about another issue where there's been a struggle to reconcile gay rights with traditional values. The issue here is same-sex marriage. For the Reverend Thomas Ogletree, a scholar of Christian ethics and a United Methodist clergyman, that issue became personal when his son asked him to officiate at his wedding to another man. He said yes, that despite the policy of the United Methodist Church, which officially forbids its clergy members from performing same-sex marriages or celebrating same-sex unions. After the wedding announcement appeared in the New York Times, Reverend Ogletree found himself the subject of a formal complaint, and he now faces a possible church trial. And he's with us now to tell us more about it. Reverend Ogletree, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should mention that you are not the only person who potentially faces a discipline over this issue in your denomination, but you are probably the highest profile given that you are a former dean of the Yale Divinity School. So I wanted to start by asking, when your son first asked you, first when he told you he was getting married, I assume that you were happy, right? Because you like the young
man. Oh, very happy, yes.
But when he asked you to officiate, did you hesitate at all?
Oh, no. I was deeply inspired. It was so joyful.
Because you particularly liked the young man? You were very happy that he was getting married? Or why?
Well, all of those things. One is, obviously, when you grow up and realize that you're gay in this culture, then you face some real challenges. Well, I've been supportive of him since his, you know, high school days, and watching him gain strength and leadership. And then when he met Nick Haddad, who is also an extraordinary person, seeing these two men build bonds and friendship really over a number of years was very inspiring. And then they wanted me to do it, which was very meaningful because I admire these men so much.
Did you think at the time that it would cause a ruckus?
I knew it was a violation of the discipline. It has been since 1996. It was declared to be a chargeable offense. At the same time, because I was retired and I'd spent most of my time as a professor and a dean, I hadn't really thought about it as having a serious impact on my life. And frankly, my son Tom and Nick were the ones who chose to publish their wedding in the New York Times. If they had not published it, then it would not have been known. I would have heard nothing by it. But once it was published, then this provoked the response. And quite frankly, I've experienced it not as something troubling or disturbing, but as an unexpected opportunity for me to bear witness to a more open and inclusive vision of the Christian faith, and also to promote that same vision in the larger society as well. So for me, it's been an inspiring opportunity to become a public witness on this vitally important issue.
How did you find out that a complaint had been charged against you under the Book of Discipline, which ironically you helped to write?
I helped to write the section called Our Theological Task, which talked about how we think critically about the meaning of the Scripture and the gospel message. But the person who notified me was Bishop McLee. He actually called me by phone and then sent an email saying that charges had been filed. And the man who filed the complaint told me if I would promise never to do this again, then he was willing to forgive me. Well, I wasn't apologizing in any way because I thought I was doing the right thing. But I told him, though I'm retired, I'm not likely to be asked to perform another wedding, but if I were asked to, I could not in good conscience refuse.
On the other hand, the fact is a Book of Discipline does exist, and you can see where other people might argue that if you are not willing to adhere to these tenets, that you cannot continue to be held up as a standard bearer of the church, and therefore it is appropriate to separate you from at least a leadership position in the church, even though you are retired. Do you have any sympathy for that point of view?
Well,
however painful.
That's the crux of the matter. That is, the person filing the complaint, when we met together with the bishop, simply said, "You broke the law." And he didn't ask whether the law could be justified. But, of course, I pointed out that the United Methodist Discipline opens with a history reminding us that as a church, we once supported slavery. And after the Civil War, we supported a segregated version of Methodism, and we denied women ordination. And so we acknowledge that sometimes we are divided and we have to struggle with our differences, and people seeking justice know they've got to be patient. See, some people say, why don't you just leave the church? But I'm saying, no, the Methodist Church has fundamental principles that can undergird changes we need to make, and I'm going to stay there to support them as best I can.
Before we let you go, I can't help but notice that your wife, your son's mom, is also a minister. She's a United Church of Christ, right?
That's correct. Yes.
So presumably she would not have been sanctioned by her denomination had she performed the ceremony. So were you ever tempted to say, ask mom?
Yeah, I could have said that, yeah. But they asked me, and so I wanted to do it.
Well, there you go. That was the Reverend Thomas Ogletree. He is a Methodist minister, as we said. He's also the retired dean of Yale Divinity School, and he joined us from a studio in New Haven, Connecticut. Reverend Ogletree, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I appreciate your questions very much.
And now it's time for a Back Talk. That's where we hear from you. Editor Ahmad Omar is here with me once again. What's going on today, Ahmad?
Hey, Michelle. We talked twice this week about New York City Police Department's so-called stop and frisk policy. There's a lawsuit challenging the way the department carries that out because critics say it targets Black and Hispanic people. Anyway, you talked to Heidi Grossman, who's the city's lead attorney in the case, and you asked her why there are no Black or Hispanic people on the city's legal team for this lawsuit. So right after the interview, we got a heated response from Ms. Grossman's office. They later sent along this statement from Celeste Kuhleveld. She's the Executive Assistant Corporation Counsel for Public Safety. And she says, quote, "By questioning the racial composition of the city's legal team, Ms. Martin made assumptions about the attorneys based solely on the color of their skin. An ironic turn in a discussion about alleged racial profiling. We trust that NPR's audience does not share her concerns about our sensitivity to the issues or our commitment to upholding civil rights." Well, Michelle, our audience did write in. A few agreed with the New York City Law Department there, like R. Dennis Hager from Millington, Maryland, who says, "I rue the day when legal representation is tainted by the quota system. I would not want my tax dollar to be spent loading up the legal team for the sake of balance." But Michelle, most people who wrote in thought the questions were valid, including someone you might have heard of. We got a letter from Frank Serpico. He's a retired New York Police Department detective, and he blew the lid off police corruption in the NYPD back in the 1970s. He was later portrayed by Al Pacino in the classic movie Serpico. Detective Serpico says it was amusing that Ms. Grossman says her legal team picked its attorneys based on merit, and he says, quote, "I guess no such person could be found among people of color," unquote.
Well, thanks, Ahmad, and as always, we suggest that if you missed it, you listen to the conversation yourself and draw your own conclusions. Thanks, Ahmad.
Thank you.
And remember, at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. We're also on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. Martin Luther King Jr., Thurgood Marshall, Sarah Vaughan, Duke Ellington. That sounds like the guest list of a party you wish you'd been invited to. And in a way you were, because all of these famous names were regular visitors to one of New Orleans' best loved restaurants. For decades, Duke E. Chase's has been a gathering place where the famous and the not so famous line up for a plate or two of Leah's equally famous Creole cuisine. Now the woman known as the Queen of Creole Cuisine adds another feather to her cap this weekend when the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience presents her with the Ella Brennan Lifetime Achievement Award. And Leah Chase is with us now from Duke E. Chase's in New Orleans. Welcome. Congratulations on this honor.
Well, thank you so much. You know, this to me is really, really an honor.
I was going to ask you if awards like this at this stage, I mean, you've had so many accolades. Everybody's just adores you. Does it still mean something to get an award like this?
It does. It really, you're grateful for it. And what it does for me is just like you taking your empty automobile to the gas station and getting the tank filled up. So when I get an award, it just gives me courage to keep going.
How would you describe the Duke E. Chase experience?
Well, it's been up and down. As I tell people, like Langston Hughes said, it sure ain't been no crystal staircase. But it's always fun. People come in, they say, "Well, Leah, you fed this president, you fed President Bush twice, you fed this one, President Obama." But presidents come and go. It's that everyday customer that comes and tell you, like when I was coming out here to talk to you, one lady said, "I remember coming here when I was in high school." So that is a good feeling for me, you know, that people remember me. I couldn't live, honey, without people.
I wanted to go back and ask about the restaurant and its history. You started working at Duke E. Chase's when you got married. It was originally your husband's parents' restaurant. It was a lot.
Right.
It was different, though, right? Then
it was.
What it became.
It wasn't what it is today, because you see, it was segregation back in those days, and you know, blacks couldn't eat in white restaurants, and so we didn't know. So my mother-in-law, great lady she was really a visionary. And when her husband got sick and couldn't go out, she took on a sandwich shop and she made it grow.
But you had a different vision, as I recall. You had worked in restaurants in the French Quarter.
Yes.
And you had hoped
I worked
to
French Quarter
make
in
it a little bit, and make it a little bit more what would you say? Fancy?
Make it more like a restaurant. You mm-hmm. see, because black people had what we call just like little sandwich shops, and we didn't know restaurants as I knew them when I worked in the French Quarters, when you went and there was a white tablecloth and the tables were set and all this kind of thing, because we were not able to go in to see what they were all alike. So when I went to work there, I just loved it. I loved it. I met a lot of people, Sir Doris Duke and Ricky Alvarez. So I learned to appreciate that, appreciate food. So when you learn something, I believe that you got to pass it on. So I said, "Well, wait, we got to bring this to my side of the town."
I read in an interview with you in the Times a while back that you said that you had hoped that you could do things like lobster thermidor and the cream sauces, but folks on your side of town weren't exactly going for that, as
because
I recall.
They hadn't, listen, honey, they had no knowledge of that. We were not allowed in those restaurants where they served the cream sauces, so what did we know? And I will go to my grave saying the best thing about integration is people were educated into other things. You learn about other cultures, you learn about food, you learn about a lot of things.
Well, as you've noted, though, already, it isn't just African-Americans who appreciate your food. And President Bush certainly was a person who visited the restaurant and loved it, and you've had lots of recognition. I wondered, though, did it bother you that you didn't really become recognized as a chef until relatively late in your career? Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me. When I started the French Quarters, you know, I was like the first women to wait tables. They had only men back there before the 40s. And to tell you the truth, chefs were not recognized anywhere like they are today. You know, we had in the kitchens, in the big kitchens, in the big houses, you had black men. And they were just cooks, honey. So they just did what they knew and went on. Then, you know, you got a little bit more sophisticated, which is good. Times educate you, it makes you do different. So then your chef had to be educated. Your chef had to go to culinary school. He had to have a degree in all of that kind of stuff. So that's when the poor black guys got cut out because they did not have that. So you know who replaced all those black men?
No, who?
It's funny, it's same white women. And I was pretty proud of that. It's such a wonderful thing to see growth. Honey, that is the best thing for me living this long, is I have seen people grow. I've seen cities grow. I've seen times change, wonderful changes, and I love it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with the legendary Leah Chase, the queen of Creole cuisine. She has just earned another honor for her lifetime of achievement in New Orleans cuisine. You know, you were saying earlier that this is quoting the Langston Hughes poem, Life Hasn't Been a Crystal Stair. We spoke really a couple of years ago after Hurricane Katrina, and your restaurant was damaged after that.
I lost everything.
And I know it's painful to think about, but I wanted to ask, how did you get through that experience?
You know, honey, that's how I know I am stoned out of my mind crazy. Because, you know, when things hit me, you know, I can't stop and feel sorry. Or you might go home and take a cry, but you get up and you go again. And when this hit me and I came in here and saw everything gone, I said, oh, my goodness. And what I was, 83 years old then? I was old. And people say, well, why are you going back? But what else was there for me to do? And thank goodness so many people helped me. So when people help you, then I think the only way I can show you I appreciate you or I care about you is doing for you. That's the only thing I know.
Do you have a favorite dish?
A favorite dish?
Yeah, what's your favorite thing to cook?
I like to cook everything, but my favorite thing to cook is to stuff things. I like to stuff chicken breasts. I like to stuff everything, you know. And everything I eat, I said, oh, I could stuff that. I went down to, and I love oxtails. I went down to a place, one of John Besh's restaurants, and I loved it, and he pulled it off the bone. I thought I was going to have to gnaw that bone. And I said, oh, this is a good idea. Now I could take this whole oxtail, take the bone out, and stuff it. Stuff it. I'm always thinking about stuffing things, even stuffing people.
Well, congratulations again. I'm wondering what they're going to serve you at the event.
Okay, I don't care what they serve me, darling, as long as they serve me.
Well,
I tell
right.
them all the time, as long as you sit me down to a table, I eat anything as long as you serve it to me.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time. I know you're a famously tireless worker, so I'm very appreciative that we were able to lure you away from the restaurant long enough to talk about this. So
well,
thank you
so much, dear, and good luck to you. And one day you have to come so I can stuff you.
All right, that's a date. Leah Chase is the queen of Creole cuisine. Her latest honor is the Ella Brennan Lifetime Achievement Award from the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. And she was kind enough to take just a few minutes to speak with us from the legendary Dookie Chase's restaurant in New Orleans, Louisiana. Chef Chase, thank you so much.
Thank you, darling, and good luck. Okay?
Okay. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, with us from Chicago. Here in Washington, D.C., civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. We hope Pablo Torre will be joining us. He's a senior writer with ESPN.com. We understand he's making his way to the studio. And Jeff Yang is a columnist with the Wall Street Journal Online. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, Michelle, you know it's Asian Pacific Heritage Month, right?
And
I'm privileged to be surrounded by all my brothers of other colors from other mothers. So let's get it jumping. Thanks so much for coming out, guys, for a fresh cut. How we doing?
It's an Asian invasion, Holmes.
it's good to have you in. Jeff Yang.
Hello. What's up, man?
Hey, man, I haven't seen you since this morning on the internet. It's good to see you. All right, well, let's get things started. President Obama, he's up to it again. He's up to his neck. He spoke about his administration counterterrorism policies yesterday, or at least he tried to. He got through it despite a relentless heckler. Michelle?
You know, he did. He talked about drones. He was at National Defense University. His staff had signaled that this would be a major address, addressing some of the issues that a lot of people talked about, including drones and closing down the military prison at Guantanamo Bay. He was repeatedly interrupted, though, by Medea Benjamin of the activist group Code Pink. And here's a clip.
I'm about to address it.
Commander-in-Chief.
Let me address it.
Close Guantanamo today.
Why don't you let me address it, man?
Those 86 prisoners.
Why don't you sit down and I will tell you exactly what I'm going to do.
Wow.
I'm so fascinated by this because Medea Benjamin is so well known
for
disrupting these events of not just current officials but former officials.
Yeah.
That I'm just fascinated by why they don't have to figure that out. But you
know, she had a ticket.
And that went on for a bit, before she got thrown out. Yeah, and you know, before we talk about the actual speech, I'm curious what you guys thought about how Obama handled it. Jeff Yang, what did you think of the sideshow?
You could tell he's getting a little bit stressed, but you know he's a cool cucumber, and I don't think that I don't think he did any worse than I would have myself. He didn't call security to escort her out immediately or something, but I think that she was. I wonder to a certain extent whether or not she was let in almost to put a pin in that particular point, you know, that there is a significant part of, maybe it's some kind of fourth dimensional chess sort of thing, you know, where it's like, let's get the progressive voice out there, you know, put the hecklers out in front, and then Obama kind of looks a little bit more, moderate perhaps in mm-hmm. his decision to push back on the global war on terror as a result. That's thinking too far ahead.
Well, he tried to drop some knowledge on her by telling her, you know, that freedom of speech was, you know, letting him get a word out edgewise, you know. But my whole thing, I'm a big fan of the hecklers. I know that's kind of counterintuitive, but I think we need people like that sometimes, occasionally, when the shoes aren't being thrown, to keep our leaders keep our leaders on topic. A-Train.
Yes, sir.
Any quick thoughts before we move on, man?
Well, it's good that Medea Benjamin kept her Skechers on, right? I mean, it's one of those situations, you know, as Michelle said, you know, Medea Benjamin from Code Pink is very well known to, you know, heckle political administration officials. So anybody who gave Medea Benjamin a ticket knew full well what they were getting. It was interesting, obviously, to note that, you know, Medea has... She's bipartisan in her heckling. You know, she has heckled. Mm-hmm. She spent 8 years heckling the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and the like. And so, if anything, it shows a little bit of consistency, in her hecklerology.
Well, why don't we wheel around, though, and ask about the substance of the speech, though?
Right.
I'm curious. I mean, Arsalan, what about the substance of the speech? I mean, he gave a very detailed defense of his administration's policy on this particular issue. And I'm interested in what. The news on Guantanamo wasn't really news in the sense that he established before he was elected that he wanted to close it. And then the question is, you know, can he close it under his own authority?
Yeah.
And I think most people don't believe, he clearly says he doesn't believe he can. But what about on the drone issue? That
right.
clearly is within the scope of his authority. What do you think about what he said?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, there was no earth-shattering, substantive, radical policy change that he outlined in his speech at the National Defense University. But what he did do was offer some insight and a little bit of transparency into programs that really, for all intents and purposes, had no transparency at all, you know, particularly focusing on the drone programs. Earlier last week, Attorney General Eric Holder, in a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, actually for the first time acknowledged that the United States has actually killed four American citizens, including Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the purported head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, his 16-year-old son, Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, Jude Muhammad, and Samir Khan, who were also American citizens. So this was the first time that the administration actually admitted to killing four Americans on foreign soil through the drone program. What was interesting to me was his statements on the authorized use of military force, which is known in shorthand as the AUMF of 2001, which basically granted the Bush administration at the time, you know, essentially a worldwide battlefield and an indefinite war. And the talk from President Obama to say that he wants to rein in the AUMF and not reauthorize it, which would actually be a step in a very good direction.
Jimmy, what do you think?
I think he promised to be transparent, and I think he's kept his promise because a lot of us, or at least a lot of his critics, can see through his equivocating. I don't know that he said anything solid. I'm sorry. To me, I just want to hear him come out and say, you know what? I'm the president. War is hell. And there's nothing else I can say about it. You know, I mean, because to me, that's how I look at it. I mean, he's the president. I trust him to make these decisions, and I wouldn't want to be him having to make these decisions. But we elected him. Let him make his decisions, and don't make him have to dance for his dinner. Just you know, war is hell. It just is what it is. What are you going to do?
Okay, dancing for his dinner is kind of his job, though, isn't it? I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, columnist Jeff Yang, and sports columnist Pablo Torre has made it to the New York City. Yay.
All right.
Back to you, Jimmy.
Fashionably late.
Fashionable. All right, back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Well, Obama versus Heckler was the only trash-talking showdown. Pro golfer Sergio Garcia made a salty remark about Tiger Woods recently.
He did. He was asked if he would have dinner with Tiger Woods at the upcoming U.S. Open. You know that they've had some friction between those two. And Garcia said, quote, "We'll have him round every night. We'll serve fried chicken."
Oh, ouch. Doggone it. Well, he apologized, though, right, Michelle?
Yeah, okay. Well, he says he feels sick about it. I'll play a short clip.
Of course
Here it
does.
Is. All right.
Mm-hmm. I obviously was caught off guard by the question. But don't get me wrong, I understand that my answer was totally stupid and out of place. You know, I can't say sorry enough about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You think?
Thanks, Michelle. You know, fellas, my question, it's simple. Was this racist or is this whole thing overblown or is it a little bit of both? A-Train, Arsalan, what do you think? Jump in here, man.
Hell yes, it was racist. And the reason that I say that is because if he was talking about a white golfer, would he have referred to fried chicken in inviting him over for dinner? What was interesting to note for me is the fact that this fried chicken stereotype has apparently made its way across the pond to Spain because Sergio Garcia is from Spain. And so, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, we have these tired stereotypical tropes here in the United States, but apparently it's making it across internationally as well.
Well, your boy Jimmy likes a yard dog, a yard bird every now and again, so hey, fried chicken is okay with me. P-Dog, Pablo Torre, you're the sports writer, man.
I mean, first off, this joke was super corny. Let's admit to that. It was just a bad joke, and he kind of, if the context means anything, I mean, look, this was a back-and-forth trash-talking brinksmanship for a while, and then Sergio Garcia goes and does this, and everything is sort of like, oh, God, here we go again. I mean, this is Fuzzy Zeller in 97 referencing. Mm-hmm. This is echoes of all of the sort of the legacy of racism that Tiger Woods, at his age, has already faced. And this speaks to the legacy of golf, really. And look, I think the comment was racist. I don't think necessarily that Sergio Garcia is a virulent racist, but golf has a race problem. And if I'm golf, if I'm the PGA Tour from the European Tour, I am punishing this. I'm suspending Sergio Garcia in the same way that the NBA or the NFL or MLB would, and probably harsher because it has this legacy where this is something that golf has had to grapple with for decades and decades, and maybe the worst sport on record in terms of having to deal with race relations.
Just to clarify what he was talking about with Fuzzy Zeller back in 1997 when he was asked about his thoughts about Tiger Woods' impending success at the Masters, and he joked about Woods serving fried chicken or collard greens or whatever they eat to celebrate. And he wasn't sanctioned by the sport either, but he did lose his main sponsor after that. I don't know, Jeff, what do you think?
Okay, so I kind of agree that this is not per se a Spain thing so much as a golf thing. I mean, come on, you know, golf racist? We're so shocked, right? But that said, I do want to put a point on the fact that there have been incidents of Spanish athletes in the past being kind of racist. I mean, if we remember during the Olympics when the Spanish basketball team paid homage to Beijing by doing these sort of, you know, slanted eye expressions.
Oh, right.
And actually, it doesn't even end there. I mean, just this morning I was reading that the head of the Euro Tour of PGA, actually, in attempting to explain away what our friend Sergio did, said, oh, you know, pay no attention to him. He has a lot of friends who are colored as well or something.
Oh.
It just rolls on and on.
Face palm.
Thank you for your
thoughts on that, man. You know
what's
interesting to me, though, is that it's curious that it brings up again the whole question of Tiger Woods' identity. I mean, who famously decided that he was Cablin Asian.
And
he
decided is he black
though,
this week?
His first ad for American Express talked about his being barred from, you know, golf courses because of the color of his skin. And then subsequently, you know. So it talks about how – it's just curious to me, though, and worth noting that he didn't identify – you know, he didn't say – we'll have pad thai. We're not going to have noodles. Right. We're going to have this is the aspect of his identity that he decided to pick on, and that is the question that I'm wondering. Why is that the particular aspect of his identity that he thought trying to demean him, right?
Because trash talking is about trying to hurt the other person without trying to hurt them badly. So that's mm-hmm. why. You know, he pricked at something that he knows that Tiger is very sensitive about.
And I'd also note that this was probably the most vociferous reply from Tiger Woods, albeit on Twitter, in response to a race relations question, as Michelle sort of hinted. He's been very marketplace-oriented, not really getting involved in stuff like this because he wants to be everything to everybody. But now you finally saw Tiger lashing back a little bit, and I kind of liked it.
You know, realistically, though, I think at this point it probably is good for him to, you know, sort of be seen more as the victim for a little while.
Just also given... that? Also
yeah,
that
absolutely.
Some brand management work involved?
Or maybe it's his own feelings. This is, I think it's sort of an evolving question. You know what I mean? Whether maybe his own thoughts about this have changed. I mean, I don't know. It's so hard to say with celebrities. You never really know what they think, do you? I mean, you know. But before we go, I wanted to ask you about one more thing. This is something that we've talked about in the shop before. The Boy Scouts of America voted to lift the ban on gay youth serving as scouts, but they wanted to keep the ban. They've decided to keep the ban for gay Scout leaders. Now, Jeff, I was going to ask you about this first because you're a former Boy Scout.
I am. I have to admit to that. I had a terrible and traumatic time with the Boy Scouts, and I saw firsthand what it was like to be the subject of discrimination, if you will, in my troop, where it wasn't so much that I was Asian, but just sort of like a fat kid with glasses. And at the same time, I mean, you know, this is an organization that did not desegregate until 1973. The Girl Scouts have allowed, you know, lesbians to be, you know, members and even scout leaders, I believe, for many years. So I think that they've got a lot to prove still, and I'm still kind of bitter and resentful.
You would let your boy scout? Would you let him scout if he wanted to?
Would I let my boy scout?
Yeah.
I mean, look, if they wanted to, you know, I'd probably allow them to, but I would inform them of the fact that, you know, there are real issues and they should think about whether or not their friends or, you know, future friends would be allowed to be a part of this organization. And if that were the case, if they weren't allowed to, do they really want to be a member of it?
And I would wonder, too, and I'm a former Cub Scout. I did
Pablo.
My fair share of a boat regattas made of balsa wood. But look, what I would say is there also may be a brand management question here in the other direction that the Boy Scouts should consider. I mean, how relevant are the Boy Scouts over time? And is this really the direction they want to go in if they are, in fact, pushing back against homosexuality as a concept? I just feel like the future youths of America, as demographics sort of show, will be increasingly less okay with those stances, and whether the Boy Scout wants to adapt with that is a, maybe a marketplace question too.
Arsalan, what do you think?
Well, you know, as the resident barbershop lawyer, it would behoove me. I would be remiss if I did not mention that the Boy Scouts, as a private organization, they do have the legal right to discriminate against whoever they want. But I agree with both Pablo and Jeff that it's definitely a bad look. I mean, I know they've lost sponsorships and things like that, and you know, it really sort of ties in to the relevancy question in terms of how relevant are the Boy Scouts going mm-hmm. to be in America moving forward.
Well, what do you make of it as a kind of as a compromise, though? Because remember, they voted on this question only a couple of years ago
right.
and voted to, at that time, to keep the ban. And now this is a change. As a compromise, I mean, if you're a person who wishes to be a scout leader, you can understand how hurtful that is. But to say, well, we don't want you, on the other hand, I don't know, as a compromise, what
right.
does it say about your institutions grappling with this?
Right, but what I think is that, you know, if you're going to, you know, pass a policy saying that gay boys can join the Boy Scouts, then why not, you know, actually go forward and, you know, why do you have to, you know, half throttle something when you can actually make a big change and send a message to the rest of America?
Jimmy, what do you think?
It's bigoted. It's bigoted, but having said that, I'm okay with living in a country where we can have these conversations, and you can be bigoted if you want. Yeah, I mean, it's your clubhouse. You can let in who you want to let in. It may cost you some money. It may cost you some friends. You know, you're not going to influence people this way. You're not going to be the dinner party guest of choice, but you can be a bigot if you want. God bless America.
Jimmy, you can always come to my clubhouse.
That's what you say
bro.
Now. Jimmy, would you let your son join, Jimmy?
Yeah, I would. My son doesn't really have interest in those kind of things. My older stepson did at one point. It faded away. But yeah, of course, why not?
Well, we've discussed why not.
I gotta tell my sons that if they want that they should join the Girl Scouts. That's rude.
Well, it is an interesting question okay. because there are some of the churches who house or host some of the scout troops are saying some of them may not wish to host them anymore, yeah. and some are saying that they will. Yeah, so it's clearly an evolving question. It's clearly an evolving question. So
such a 1950s Leave It to Beaver sort of organization. They need to modernize, I think, personally.
Yeah,
I think there's always a place for not tying. That's what I'm saying. All right.
There needs to be like a skateboarding
some whittling,
medal or something.
Some
skateboard. There might be a patch for skateboarding. We don't know.
Yeah.
Jimmy Israel.
Video game patches.
There might be that too. I don't know. Jimmy Israel's a writer and culture critic. He's also an adjunct professor of film at social media at Cuyahoga Community College. He was with us from NPR member station WBEZ in Chicago. Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN.com. He made it to our NPR studios in New York to join Jeff Yang, who's a columnist with
buzzer.
The Wall Street Journal Online, and Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney and founder of LaMuslimGuide.com here in Washington, D.C. Thank you all.
Peace.
I wouldn't have missed this for the world, Michelle. You know that.
I know you wouldn't.
Yep, yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast that's in the iTunes store or at NPR.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.